night, as you know, the Senate passed important legislation. We're very proud of the product. We think it is, we did jujitsu on it, that it went from a corporate first proposal that the Republicans put forth in the Senate to a workers first, Democratic workers first legislation.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi praising the Senate's unanimous passage of the stimulus bill. The House is expected to approve it tomorrow. It is the largest economic stimulus package in history, $2 trillion. Single adults making $75,000 or less will get a direct payment of $1,200 plus $500 per child. It'll boost unemployment benefits by $600 a week and provide 13 extra weeks of benefits. And it would cover people who wouldn't normally be eligible, like freelancers and Uber drivers. Well, that's some good news, given the Labor Department's figures out today showing more than 3 million people filed for unemployment last week. We're going to talk about what all this means now with Jesse Rothstein. He's an economics professor at UC Berkeley, and he was also the chief economist for the Department of Labor during the Obama administration. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, 3 million plus new unemployment claims last week, pretty shocking, highest ever. Do you think that this stimulus package will do a lot to help these people?
I think it will. It's hard to overstate how big this shock was. That 3.3 million is triple or quadruple the highest we've ever seen before, and I expect it to double again next week. There's a huge hole that we've created in the economy by asking people not to go to work, and what we need is measures to help people stay afloat while they're not working and help people stay attached to their employers while they're not working, so we can keep some of them out of the unemployment insurance system. I think this bill does both of those things, and I think it will help a lot.
So when you say double, you think next week it'll be 6 million people?
Nobody knows for sure, but I think that's the right magnitude. The data that came out today are about claims last week, which was before much of the country had gone into shelter-in-place mode.
And that doesn't even count people who are like gig workers or people who are on furlough who may have not filed or people finding difficulty filing because the state unemployment offices are so overwhelmed. So there might be even more than that, right?
Definitely. I think there's a huge flood of unemployment happening right now. Again, many employers are trying to keep people on as long as they can, and this bill will make that possible. There's a measure in it that allows many employers to get tax credits to cover the cost of keeping workers on for the next couple of months, and that will be really important.
Okay. There is some thought out there that this will just be the first of many stimulus packages that need to be put through. What do you think about that?
I think it's quite possible. I think we really don't know how long this will last. It's been roughly a week or two now, and if it goes on for another week, then maybe this is enough. If it goes on for months, then we may need much more than this. To put it in perspective, in the Great Recession, we had the American Recovery Act. That was an $800 billion program spent over 2 years. The rough estimate of the hole that we've created in the economy now is about $1 trillion a month. So that means we need a Recovery Act every month for the next, as long as this lasts. This bill is two Recovery Acts, and so it'll cover us for a little while, but I think we may well need more.
Is that even feasible? Can the federal government continue to do this for the foreseeable future?
I think it can for a while. We don't know how. Hopefully this won't last for a year, but if this is a month or two, I think the government can. We have historically low interest rates. I think there's not a lot of other places to put your money. And I think that we need this to keep ourselves afloat until we can all go back to work.
What about the idea of paying businesses directly to keep employees hired, even if they're not working?
I think it's a great idea, and that's part of this bill. There are two real concerns that I have right now. One is that workers will have trouble surviving without pay during this period. And you can cover that either by having the businesses pay them or through unemployment insurance. But the other is that we need to keep the businesses alive and keep the employment relationships intact so that when we do come out of this, the businesses will be able to go back to normal. if the businesses are all forced to shut down and lay off all the workers, it's going to be a much harder recovery when everybody's let out of their houses.
Can you talk about how this affects California in particular? We have a huge surplus, a huge rainy day fund, but it could be wiped out by this crisis, correct?
I think that's right. We thought it was a huge rainy day fund, and then the mother of all rainy days came. And so I don't know that it's all that huge in perspective. There is money in the federal bill to help state and local governments, which will be very important. But this is what rainy day funds are for, and we're going to need every penny of it.
Over on the other side of the country, Governor Andrew Cuomo blasted the stimulus bill as he called it reckless and irresponsible, because it only gives New York $5 billion and only for COVID-related expenses, whereas he estimates that New York, just one state, will lose between $10 and $15 billion. Is that something along the lines that you're seeing in California?
I don't know yet exactly how big the hit will be to California. I think it's going to take a while to play out. I think the way to think about this bill is we needed something immediately to deal with the people who are not getting paid this week. But I don't think we should think that this is the last bill we'll pass. And some of the longer time horizon impacts, we'll need another bill to deal with. I think this will get us through to another day, and that's what we need right now.
Right. I'm seeing the word depression being bandied about by economists. Are your fellow economists, your colleagues, talking about us possibly entering into another Great Depression?
I think nobody has any idea. I think we're worried about it, and I think one of the needs for packages like this is to make sure that doesn't happen. That the reduced consumption happens while people are confined to their houses and on various kinds of lockdowns, but then the people have the resources to go spend and businesses face demand once everybody is set free. I think if we don't make sure that we maintain people's resources, then I think there's a real risk of a depression.
Jesse Rothstein from UC Berkeley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
There are not enough ventilators.
We've procured about 7,000 ventilators. We need, at a minimum, an additional 30,000 ventilators. You cannot buy them. You cannot find them. They're technical pieces of equipment. They're not manufactured in 2 days or 4 days or 7 days or 10 days.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo talking about the shortage in his state. It's one of the deadliest aspects of this coronavirus, how it attacks the lungs, and that's why ventilators are so important. But manufacturers are struggling to meet the demand amid a worldwide shortage. Two local doctors are taking matters into their own hands. Andrew Frankel and Brian Wong are both facial plastic surgeons here in LA. Dr. Frankel is trying to organize a nationwide network to get ventilators that might be sitting idle in private practices into hospitals that need them. And Dr. Wong, who is also a biomedical engineer at UC Irvine, is leading a team that's trying to create a lower cost ventilator for people who don't need the most intensive care. And they're both on the line now. Welcome.
Hello, Madeline.
All right, Dr. Wong, let's begin with you. Talk about what we have learned so far from the outbreak in China.
Well, this is a disease that really does hit the respiratory system, in other words, the lungs. And the biggest challenge is the individual that needs additional support to sustain ventilation. So the key element in what separates an ICU from a regular bed is the presence of skilled nursing, as well as these ventilators, which are life-sustaining devices and are of limited availability in a global pandemic as such we have.
Right. And you heard Governor Cuomo there say that these are not easily manufactured. They take a very long time to make. They're very complicated pieces of equipment. What you're doing is not creating those ventilators, but something kind of in between. Can you talk about what you're trying to design?
You don't need a Ferrari to carry a bag of potatoes. So this idea sprung from interactions in our operating room about using a resuscitation bag, generically known as an AMBU bag, or rather the other way around, that the human hand squeezes to deliver air. So you can't squeeze a bag for 72 days or 72 hours, but you can make a machine that will do exactly just that.
Okay, and how far along are you in that?
We have working prototypes in Texas with our collaborators. And again, it's a consortium. It's not one person. And we have one that, you know, it's almost ready to deploy. We're also working on several different models simultaneously.
Okay, so I'll get into the details in just a bit, but Dr. Frankel, I want to bring you into this. You are tangentially involved with that project, but also your own project of trying to source existing ventilators. Can you talk about how you came up with that idea?
Well, a few weeks ago, a colleague of mine shared an email that she received from her friend in Italy who was working on the front lines, and he was very emphatic about the shortage of ventilators and the terrible ethical decisions the doctors were having to make in choosing who to ventilate and who to let pass away. And I remember thinking at that moment, wow, I have three anesthesia machines and they all have ventilators, and that's a pretty difficult scenario. Last Tuesday, the city of Beverly Hills shut down all elective surgery, and that meant my facility was going to be closed. And I thought to myself, well, I have these machines, and I probably should get them somewhere where they can be of best use. And if I have these machines, then there may be many of my colleagues around the city who have similar situations. So I started reaching out, and one of my good friends is the COO of Medline Industries, and he's very connected with all governmental and hospital systems throughout the country. I called him within a few minutes. I was connected to the governor of California, governor of New York, governor of Illinois, and the director of operations for Providence Healthcare Systems. And what I got out of those conversations was what was really needed was a central registry of all the available ventilators that might be able to be used for this situation. So I reached out to my professional organization, which is the American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery, and we began a project to list to all the members a survey where they could offer up their machines if they wanted to. If we can get a central registry, we feel that'll be the most efficient way for the various systems and governments to use these resources without duplicity.
Right. So it's not just plastic surgeons who have these ventilators. There are all sorts of ambulatory centers that have them.
That is correct. However, not everything that's done in these outpatient surgical centers is cosmetic surgery or entirely elective. And so one of the problems we're having is that many of these machines still need to be used to treat the general population who have medical issues that require procedures.
And just your best guess, how many of these ventilators do you think are out there that could be repurposed?
Well, this morning I was informed that there may be as many as 10,000 throughout the country. But it seems that it's going to be a Herculean task to get anywhere near that number to be donated. I think the major hurdle here is that any operating room that's currently sitting idle because of a moratorium or prohibition on their work, the owners of those facilities are not making any income whatsoever. And to offer up their ventilator would mean that they're risking not getting their ventilator back when the moratorium is lifted. In that situation, they haven't been making income for maybe weeks or months, and now they request their machine back, and the machine is not able to come back to them, or it's been in a state of disrepair or something, and then they cannot generate income. They can't return to business as normal. And that puts the owner of these machines in a very big ethical dilemma of taking care of the people they're responsible for, such as family, such as their own employees and their business, versus lending these out to places where they can save lives. And what we're trying to do is set up a situation with paperwork that would provide assurances for these entities that if they give their machines out, they are, in fact, going to get them back quickly.
Wow, yeah. What about you personally? Where are your ventilators right now?
They're currently in my center as I'm working on this initiative, and they're ready to go out the moment we have a clear path of where they're going to go. And that offers up the next big issue here is we give this registry to higher powers. These powers, we're hoping, will put them into play where they're needed most on a timely basis. We're not sure of exactly where the government is going to be able to determine on a real-time basis who should get these machines and at what moment, which brings us back to Dr. Wong's project, which is fascinating and which will save lives, because they're going to be able to manufacture lots of these life-saving devices and distribute them where they're needed to.
So, Dr. Wong, your bridge ventilator, as you're calling it, this is for people who are suffering from a less acute need and don't need the full ventilator. How fast do you think you could get these made and into the hands of doctors who need them?
It's a really tough question to answer. It's an engineering design issue. If Medtronic is building a ventilator, it has to work 99.9999% of the time, and that's a multi-year development process. What we're hoping to get is a device that works maybe 95% of the time. That's an incredible hurdle. The problem is you don't know if it's going to be a 95% device or 70% device, and if it's a 70% device, you've done a disservice. So by having a team decentralized with multiple individuals evaluating, validating, and testing, we hope to be able to accelerate that process of trying to get to 95%. In the meantime, we have alternate designs going out there that could be built in as little as 5 hours by probably a very small team of mechanical and electrical engineers. We're talking 2 or 3 people.
And so what kind of help do you need from the government, from public officials?
They're already part of this. Governor Newsom's people have reached out to us. The FDA has created a streamlined regulatory process to get these type of devices out there. We've had buy-in from individuals like Jim Abrams at Medline to be able to streamline the process of supply of testing materials. So I think government can help by streamlining the regulatory approach. Getting information out there to teams that have the capability to do this would be critically important. It's a Dunkirk endeavor, and I think at some point, yes, people in the community that are modders or hackers, the type of guy or gal that designs a drone, could be building these type of devices once the design has been validated and tested.
All right. Well, wishing you the best of luck, both of you, in your endeavors, and thank you so much for all the work that you're doing. That's Dr. Brian Wong and Dr. Andrew Frankel, both facial plastic surgeons, and Dr. Frankel working on a national registry for ventilators, Dr. Wong working on what he's calling a bridge ventilator project. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what to do if you're feeling alone at home, advice for fighting depression and anxiety if you're living with others and they're stressing you out. That's next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you live alone, your human interaction time has pretty much plummeted because of this stay-at-home social distancing measure. Feelings of isolation or loneliness can grow and they can fester. Maybe it's hard to reach out and connect. Since the COVID-19 outbreak, phone calls to the National Suicide Prevention Hotline have gone up 300%. This is a really delicate subject matter, and we want to give listeners usable resources and coping skills for those feelings of isolation. And we're going to talk about that now with Dr. Rebecca Gutierrez, Program Director for D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services and Suicide Prevention Center in Culver City. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, what are you hearing from people who call into your center these days?
The major themes, of course, is with anxiety and stress around such uncertain times and just the immediate changes that people are seeing in their daily lives. And another common theme that we're hearing are things related to, of course, their health or health of their loved ones. What steps can they take? Asking a lot of questions of what this means for their family and how it is going to impact the physical health of themselves and their loved ones.
I imagine that with people who have existing anxiety disorders, OCD, anything like that, it's really difficult right now.
Yes, it can be, especially with these times where there's just so many changes and so many levels of uncertainty. So that in itself doesn't cause a person to be suicidal. So we just wanted to also make that clear that it doesn't make a person have thoughts of suicide or have an episode of depression. But if you are already dealing with the symptoms of mental illness, such as depression and anxiety, that can exacerbate the symptoms that they are already experiencing, which can include feelings of isolation, feeling that there's no one there to support them. So that's why it's really key that we encourage people to really take extra steps in maintaining those meaningful relationships to really counteract those feelings of loneliness, especially right now, where it can come up even more so.
For people who are living alone, are they more at risk for mental health problems? And if so, what do you recommend to them?
Yeah, so, I mean, there are some studies that show that there is somewhat of a correlation with people living alone and having an increased sense of loneliness. But I think part of it, again, comes really the key part is the social connectedness. So one of the things that we recommend for individuals who do live alone is to consistently engage in things that, you know, they do have control in, reaching out to other people, doing what they feel most comfortable with, and with people in your circles, you know that someone in your family or friend does live by themselves, then we encourage them to also reach out and check in with them and offering them a space. So it really is finding different ways of how to have an avenue of expressing your own concerns and not remaining home isolated and feeling like there's no space to really communicate any feelings or experiences that you might be having around this in general. And especially if you do have some level of mental illness, something like depression or anxiety, that can intensify those symptoms.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering how some people can be motivated to do that, because often it's a vicious circle, right? People are depressed and they don't reach out. They just kind of hunker down and isolate, self-isolate even more. So how do you break that cycle if people can't really leave their homes?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a really common experience. So what we tend to do, especially, let's say someone calls a crisis line, is that we hear the reasons of why they don't have motivation, but then we also hear for the reasons why they might, and hear why those connections might be important, and using that part of them to really help initiate and activate a part of them to really engage and take some level of action. And sometimes it's really breaking down those pieces of what they're comfortable with. First, we want to get them focused in the present. A lot of the times people are worried about what has happened and what's going to happen, all those what if scenarios that just kind of get us out of the present situation. But if we can get someone to just stay a little bit more grounded and just kind of focus, even with, you know, breathing exercises, things like that, just to help a person just recalibrate a little bit and focusing in the present, it makes it feel more doable and more realistic to take those smaller steps. So for example, if a person is maybe not yet comfortable doing a video conference with all of their friends, that might be too much. Okay, let's break it down and let's see, maybe one of those friends you feel most comfortable with, and maybe texting them for support. That could be an initial start. And maybe that's something that you could do perhaps today. So it's kind of breaking it down to make it feel like it's more palatable, in empowering and giving that person a sense of control and an ability to complete a goal.
I think a lot of us are feeling stressed out, and you just mentioned a breathing exercise. What is a breathing exercise that we can all do right now to kind of calm ourselves a little bit?
Yeah, so what we do a lot with individuals who do call us on the lines is that we just really take deep, slow breaths, trying to breathe from the diaphragm, or what I call belly breathing. So just really allowing your belly to expand expand when you're taking those inhales, and just letting it go when you exhale, and making it very slow when you inhale and slow out. So if we can do one together, I will count to three and we'll both do it together. I really encourage the person, I want to hear them through the other side of the phone, to really hear those breaths. So I'll count to three and we'll take a big breath in. So one, two, three, and exhale slowly. One, two,
Dr. Rebecca Gutierrez is program coordinator for the D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services and Suicide Prevention Center in Culver City. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Well, for those of us who don't live alone, kids are off school, maybe partners are home from work, or they've been laid off, and all this means a lot more personal time with the people we live with. That can be a mixed blessing. The phrase, too close for comfort, comes to mind. Dr. Brittany Blair is a clinical psychologist and sleep consultant at Stanford University's Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. I spoke with her earlier about how to manage the stress you may feel while cooped up in your home. What are clients telling you now? I assume that you are seeing them, but seeing them online or over the phone. What are they telling you?
So we're seeing a lot of folks making appointments, wanting to talk about their increased worry, stress, anxiety about the unknown and the uncertainty of both of what's going on and what our world's going to look like when we come out of this disaster or crisis.
Right. And so are they worried mainly about the virus itself, the pandemic, or are they coming to you with other kind of interpersonal concerns about spending so much time with family?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. So we're seeing a lot of individuals that are reporting kind of high degrees of stress and anxiety. And then we're also seeing a lot of couples who are finding that the differences that they may be able to normally navigate in a healthy way are kind of coming to the fore, being up underneath each other constantly 24/7. Many people are in smaller spaces with young children and both trying to work, maintain their job, or, you know, one of them is out of a job and the other partner is still working full time. It's just a recipe for both frustration, irritation, as well as resentment.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk about some coping skills that they can possibly employ from you, because you are an expert in that. Let's talk about couples. So usually we are not around our significant other 24/7, and that could be a good thing. How do you advise your clients who are facing that kind of stress? How are you advising them to deal with that togetherness?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I think the first thing I would recommend is for all of us to hold ourselves and our partners with compassion. Again, this is a very stressful, unprecedented time, and we're all on edge. And then I think it's important, even in really small spaces, to create separateness and distance. So every partnership needs a certain amount of connection and closeness and needs a certain amount of distance and kind of space from one another. And there are many ways that folks can do this, from designating a special spot in the home to, this is kind of my private area when I want to spend alone time, to, if you don't have the space to do something like that, using headphones, putting on some music, doing some solo activity for a little bit, just to feel like you've got some space and some distance and you're giving your partner that as well. I think also for couples with young children or families with young children, really giving each other permission to share responsibility. So one partner take them in the morning and allow the other partner to either work or have some space, and the other partner taking them in the afternoon and then maybe having family time in the evening. So really kind of thinking creatively. I've also been recommending that people really carve out specific space in the home for dedicated activities. For example, if you're working from home, one spot at the kitchen or dining room table, that is your office, and you do not take your office into your bedroom or into the kids' room or moving different places. I think this helps us demarcate kind of now his work time versus family time versus play time versus sleep time or connecting with your partner time.
Let me stop you there for a second about the work part, because a lot of us are working from home. If we're lucky, we're still working and working from home. And it's hard to do that when you've got kids around or a significant other around or anyone else around. So how do you separate the work and the home life when you're all in the home together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's quite the challenge, right? So I think one of the things, like I was mentioning, having a designated space where you could work. And then if you have young children, really partnering and taking turns with childcare. A lot of parents are schooling their children at home right now. And so having a separate space from where the work office space is. And then using, especially for kids, there's a myriad of resources online right now that are educational resources for kids to kind of give mom and dad a little bit of a break, depending on the age of the child and their ability to kind of focus themselves, looking at educational content. But it's a challenge. And I think, again, really trying to recognize that this is challenging for everybody and to give each other a little bit of a compassion and a little bit of understanding right now.
Well, also the stress of not being in work and
or having lost your job, that can also really ratchet up the stress at home and can increase potential for abuse, right, for domestic violence. China saw a rise in domestic violence cases after the outbreak there. And, you know, here in the U.S., the domestic violence hotline is fielding really high volumes of calls. And by the way, if you do need to call someone, the number is 1-800-799-SAFE. 1-800-799-SAFE. That's the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Is there something you recommend to try to mitigate that, or if you're in a potentially violent situation, what you can do?
Yeah, you know, I'll speak to that just generally. I think one of the things associated with an underlying feeling of helplessness and impotence is it's a delicate trigger for shame. And what often happens when people feel helpless or shame or incompetent or impotent is they get angry. They get irritable, they get angry, they have a short fuse. And I think that's when we can see an increased rate in both high conflict between partners as well as, unfortunately, domestic violence. It's a very real problem. And so if you feel either you or your partner are escalated in terms of their level of frustration or stress or even sadness or anxiety, I think it's really important to be able to give each other space. Maybe go take a cold shower. Again, go on a safe walk outside if you're physically distancing. You know, maybe listen to some music, put some headphones on, and just give yourself a minute to allow, you know, do a little bit of a workout. Cardio burn is great. To give yourself a little bit of a time to for that emotion to kind of dissipate and to calm down. And I think that's when you can kind of go back and have a productive conversation. And certainly if things escalate, calling the authorities and doing what it takes to protect yourself and your family.
Yeah. On the other side of it, I imagine couples have a lot more time now to, shall we say, get closer together.
Yeah, absolutely. I work with a lot of couples, and my clinic does as well. And this is a unique opportunity that we have to kind of reconnect. And I think it's a nice way to kind of positively reframe the situation that we're in. I'm encouraging couples to spend quality time together. I think one great way to get out of perseverating about the stress with the current state of affairs is to actually engage with yourself and your partner erotically. It's a way to get into your body and out of your mind and can be quite connecting. I think it's important to recognize that for 85% of people, stress actually causes their libido to go through the floor. You know, they really have lack of libido. And for 15% of people, it increases the libido. But for 100% of people, sex can be a great way to reduce stress. So what I would encourage for those 85% is maybe start engaging with your partner and see if as you're engaging, whether or not you're feeling like it initially, see if then that kind of desire follows. We call this responsive desire. It's kind of engaging, making out, maybe cuddling a bit, and then see if you notice and can tune into any kind of sexual desire there. So I think that's a nice way to kind of think of a positive reframe or thinking of something positive that can come out of this time when we're stuck at home with one another.
Definitely. So thank you so much. That is Dr. Brittany Blair. She's a clinical psychologist and sleep consultant at Stanford University Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. Dr. Blair, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, here's something to lift your spirits, something else to lift your spirits, cake.
It's just so simple. You use two bowls, you do it all by hand, you can throw it together in really 15 minutes and it's in the oven or even less.
A recipe from Evan Kleiman coming up next on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it's been a week or so of shelter in place here in LA. Dine-in restaurants have been closed, and many of us may be in some need for some inspiration in the kitchen. Well, here to help us is Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, a lot of us are in the kitchen, either happily or not happily, but we have to be in the kitchen. happily, of course, but
well,
many of us
always.
Are like, oh.
Not always. I mean, I think that whatever this bizarre experience that's happening, it's a communal experience. We are all having it together.
And last time we spoke, you gave us this delicious recipe for minestrone soup, and I made it, and I had soup for days. I was very happy. So thank you for that. And
you're welcome.
You can still check. You can still get that recipe on the KCRW website, right?
It has the greatest URL ever. It's kcrw.com/minestrone.
Simple enough. Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, today we're going to talk dessert. I'm very happy about that. What is it?
So first of all, I want to say that, you know, I'm not a recipe developer. That isn't really my life. And because of the beauty of my job at KCRW, I see like hundreds of cookbooks every year. And a cookbook that came across the desk is called Simple Cake by a woman named Odette Williams. What she does is she takes a few cakes and very few toppings, and she teaches you how to mix them up so that you have variety. But they're all super simple. And the one that I have made many, many times is what she calls her lovely lemon yogurt cake. And it's based on the famous French yogurt cake that apparently, almost mythically, people say is the only thing that French people actually make at home. And it's based on the little yogurt jar to measure with.
Oh.
It's just so simple. You use two bowls. You do it all by hand. You can throw it together in really 15 minutes and it's in the oven, or even less.
So can you use any kind of yogurt in this, or does it have to be a special French yogurt?
No, you don't use special French yogurt. Actually, for this recipe, she calls for Greek full-fat yogurt, just plain, because you're giving it the flavor by adding the lemon zest.
And we use a lot of lemons in this, or a few?
Well, you know what I like to do? Sometimes I find that grating in lemon zest into a cake, I can end up with pieces that really bother me when I'm eating. And because we have so much citrus this time of year, what I find myself doing is cutting the citrus off the fruit, whatever it is, lemon, orange, or lime, being very sure I don't get any of the bitter pith in with it. And then I just throw it in my food processor with sugar and I process them together. And what you end up with is an incredibly aromatic, flavorful sugar. And I keep them in separate jars and they last forever. And so what I do with this cake is, rather than separately zesting my lemons, I just use the amount of sugar that's called for in the recipe, but I use my lemon sugar. Or actually sometimes to change it up, I'll use orange sugar, and that sometimes makes it taste like creamsicle if you add a tiny little bit of vanilla too.
That sounds so good. So you're taking the zest of the lemon and mixing it in with the sugar really well. And often I see recipes saying it, like rub it between your fingers, rub the sugar and the lemon zest together and get the oil.
Exactly.
In there too.
And this basically you're doing in a larger amount. So because those mason jars hold 2 cups, basically, I'll use like 1.5 cups of sugar because it fluffs up. And whatever zest I want to use, I just throw it in there. And then I just process it until the zest has become pulverized and all of those fragrant essential oils are now embedded into the sugar. Then I put it in a little mason jar and label it, and I'm good to go.
And where can listeners go to find the recipe for this?
Well, we will have the recipe up on our website. It is Odette Williams' recipe from her book, Simple Cake. It really is an incredible book. I mean, one of my favorite things I've made from this book was her chocolate cake, equally easy to make, but then turned into a tres leches cake.
How can you just leave us with that and not tell us about making that one?
Cruel. You're making her chocolate cake, and then you're making the tres leches mixture, you know, mixture of condensed milk, evaporated milk, and cream. Just a little rich.
Just a little, but what else are we doing?
Pouring it over the cake and letting it soak in. So good.
Oh, we have to take our pleasures where we can find them these days. Evan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Devin Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, and check out this recipe at kcrw.com. Coming up, a project for people stuck indoors, quilting. The Quilting Cowboy joins us next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, COVID-19 is keeping a lot of us at home, basically twiddling our hopefully sanitized thumbs. Maybe it's time to learn a craft. There are YouTube videos to learn all sorts of things, cooking, knitting, and if you're feeling ambitious, quilting. One quilting instructor's videos stand apart from the others on YouTube.
And your host, everybody's favorite quilting cowboy, Dale Allen Browse.
Dale's internet presence may not be appropriate for children, the uptight heterosexual man, and the young lady in Sacramento who called me the drunk uncle of crafts.
The drunk uncle of crafts joins me now. Dale Allen Rouse, a.k.a. the Quilting Cowboy.
Hi.
Why were you called the drunk uncle of crafts?
That was someone online who called me that. And I thought it was so funny because, you know, my approach to what I do is a little bit of comedy, a little bit of theater, and a lot of crafts, right? And so I guess she wasn't really, you know, ready for my approach to what I do and how I teach. So she thought I was a little off the rails. So that was her description.
Well, the quilting community can take itself very seriously, though, right? Because there are rules about quilting.
Well, there's, you know, kind of the general market in which everyone's just having fun and everybody's making art, right? So that's just the general entry level. But for sure, once you get into, you know, the more serious art and craft of it, there really is very specific rules, especially when you enter quilts for a show or competition, then it gets really, really, really specific.
What are some of those rules?
So it's everything, the way that you sew something, the way that you attach the binding, how you actually do your corners. Are you sewing this properly or are you kind of cutting corners, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. For someone who's never quilted before, and that would be me, can you explain it? What exactly is quilting?
Now, it was born out of the very early pioneer days where they had, you know, leftover scraps of clothing. They'd put that together in such a way in order to create a quilt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those early days were really just, you know, creating something that they could use in the home. And obviously, as it's evolved, now it's become more of an art form where you can artistically, you know, really express yourself through those fabrics. And so essentially what it is taking fabrics and cutting them up into squares or shapes of different sizes and shapes to put together into kind of a tapestry or you know, just a quilt of various cut up pieces of fabric into an entire work of art. And it's really important to distinguish the difference between a quilt and a blanket. And, you know, a blanket is something that you would buy in the store, whereas a quilt is a real work of art.
Mm-hmm. Something that's hopefully handmade.
Yes, indeed.
Is it hand sewn?
So it used to be, a lot of people have moved away from that just because it's so time consuming. I did one quilt from beginning to end all by hand and it took me a year.
Wow.
Yes. So, you know, I certainly can do that, but my preference is obviously once I get an idea and I get some inspiration in order to like kind of work through it much more quickly. And there's serious techniques that we use such as strip piecing and things like that to even move it along more quickly. But yeah, that's what it is essentially.
Okay. So that's the quilting part. Where does the cowboy part come in?
That's a great question. It's an interesting story, actually. So I ended a relationship 10 years ago, almost to the month. Wow. And when I left that relationship, I'd kind of lost myself, my identity. And so when I left, like the moment I left that relationship, I just got in the car and I just drove and drove and drove. And, you know, finally, kind of when I stopped and regained my bearings, I found myself in Heber, Utah. And there was a bait and tackle shop there. And I was like, I don't know why I went in, but I did. And they had these incredible cowboy boots. And, you know, kind of having an upbringing in kind of rural Canada, that really spoke to me. And I bought a pair of cowboy boots, and I've pretty much worn them every single day since then. They really are, they just feel like my home base. And I always just swore that, you know, they would be, you know, what kind of moved me in the right direction. Besides, the URL was available, and it's just a fun name.
Well, so there's a fun juxtaposition, too, between a cowboy, which is a really macho image, and then right. the quilting part, which is kind of more of a feminine image.
Yeah, it's a real yin and yang. I just find that that intersection of the hyper-masculine and hyper-feminine together super interesting. And mm-hmm. a lot of my design work and stuff like that also kind of comes from that place. It's super interesting to me.
What about the idea of an old-fashioned hobby? It seems like people don't really take to them as they did in the past, right? We're all on our phones doing stuff like that,
right.
or I guess we're on Instagram or making our own videos or whatever, but actually sitting down with fabric and spending a lot of time, because you do have to spend a lot of time if you're going to make a quilt, on one thing, that seems kind of old-fashioned, but in a way also attractive.
But it's so beautiful. I mean, it's like my walking meditation, right? Mm-hmm. The repetition of doing something over and over and over and kind of getting lost in the rhythm of that, to me, is, just allows me to kind of have a broader experience. I sew in silence, right? I never have music on. I never have the TV on. And I'm just there. I read an article once that I found super interesting, in that people are attracted to quilting and other hobbies like that in the same reason that some people are attracted to extreme sports. And both require one thing, and this is why I believe that they're attracted to these things. They require you to be present 100% of the time.
And get into that flow.
Yeah.
Right. But exactly. There's a big difference. It's extreme sports seem extreme.
Yes, but both of them do require you to be very present in what you're doing. And so when people say that's my therapy, that's my escape, I honestly think that that's what they're talking about. That because when you're fully present in the moment, right, you're not being attacked by your ego. You're not in the past. You're not living in the future. You're just here.
How did you learn how to quilt?
Oh, I was a professional ballet dancer for almost 20 years. When we were, you know, on tour, we'd be on the bus for days. And this was back before personal handheld computers and, you know, anything like that. So you had to play cards or, you know, take up knitting or talk to people or whatever. And a lot of my friends were having babies at that time. And I really wanted to create something that felt, I don't know, I wanted to convey something in the physical world that, you know, I kind of felt internally. And a quilt just really, you know, checked all those boxes in terms of what I wanted to bring into this world, how I was feeling, and, you know, the special gift that I wanted to give to my friends who were having kids. My mom was also a sewing teacher, so even though she didn't teach me how to sew, I was very comfortable with the idea. So I just kind of taught myself on the back of the bus. Now, my first couple of quilts, you can only imagine. First of all, don't ever sew on the bus. It will be terrible.
Okay, so if I want to get into it, or someone listening to this is thinking, hey, I want to try some quilting, what's the first step?
Okay, so if you've never done it before, I would suggest going to a beginner class. If you can't do that, there are certainly online resources, and I have design quilt patterns, and I myself have a beginner quilt pattern called Tangled Rectangles. All of my patterns come with a video tutorial. So, you know, I personally learn a lot better by watching somebody do it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wanted to make sure that all of my patterns have the video tutorial so that they can watch me doing it step by step if they want that experience, or they could just read the pattern. But that tutorial is, like I said, over an hour long, and it really walks you through all of the basics so that you can go step by step. But that being said, I would suggest taking a class. Quilt guilds, a lot of people aren't familiar with what a guild is. Quilt guilds can be found in almost every city. Just call your local quilt guild or quilt shop, and they'll be able to direct you to a local class.
You're in a quilt guild, I assume.
I am, yes, here in Palm Springs.
And are you the only man in it? Be honest.
Oh, no. There's probably 15 guys.
Really?
Uh-huh. Now I'm probably the youngest, but.
All right. Well, you are the quilting cowboy after all. There's only
That's
one
right.
of you.
Dale Allen Rouse. He's also known as the Quilting Cowboy, and you can check out his tutorials online on YouTube. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Dare I say, he's also probably the most charming. That's it for us here at Press Play. Have a great rest of your day. Stay safe. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.